Well, listen, everybody, thank you very much to our friends in Regina. We're delighted to have you with us, colleagues here at the John Sozama Graduate School of Public Policy in Saskatoon. We're really fortunate to have today with us Greg Finnegan. He's going to give a series of presentations relating to, this is sort of like speed lecturing. He's got a couple of two different sort of 15 to 20 minute presentations he's going to go through, capitalizing on a unique career of statistical analysis and public policy advising in the Canadian North. Greg has a really interesting career. We discovered many years ago when I was at Brandon University, I started doing a project on protests in Western Canada before the 1885 rebellion. And in all this time, I've never found anybody who found that remotely interesting except me. And then about a month and a half ago, Greg was talking about things he was emptying out of his computer, and it turns out that he too had spent a lot of time looking at pre-1885 economic and social developments, political developments, including political petitions, in Western Canada. So not only are we both from the Yukon, but we share this rather strange connection back here into the Prairie Provinces back in the 19th century. Greg has a very unique background. His training as a PhD in historical geography and a very distinguished career as a statistician. He was the chief statistician for government of Yukon for a number of years. He's also, since that time, has worked as a consultant for a variety of communities, government agencies, organizations, across the Canadian North in particular. Anybody who does work on Nunavut, on Northwest Territories, Indigenous communities across the Territorial North, spends a lot of time with Greg's work. And as in his job as chief statistician in the Yukon, he did several things, one of which was to modernize the collection process. Not a criticism of his predecessors, but actually went back and rethought some of the data collection procedures they were using in the Yukon. Secondly, produced some of the most user-friendly statistical material you'll find anywhere in the country. Got a habit of actually getting statistics out that people would actually read and use. And if you think of the way most departmental agencies deal with statistics, the idea is to overwhelm people so nobody can understand what they actually mean. Greg's approach was to do it very much the other way. It was to make it very accessible, get it out really quickly, and partly because the Yukon is only 35,000 people, so Greg actually knew them all individually. He didn't have to use databases. He just counted his friends. But the third part of Greg's work that I think is really worth noting is that he made a concerted effort to engage statistics with the public policy process. And I have lots of friends in government at different levels in federal and territorial governments, First Nation governments in the north. And Greg was one of these sort of pesky statistical presences where he would go to meetings or be part of processes and contribute to public discussions that basically needed statistical analysis. People were sort of responding on the basis of what they thought or what they hoped. And in his very, well, he won't be quiet today, but in his public role, he was very quiet in terms of bringing material out, never embarrassing governments, never sort of contradicting politicians, but making sure that the data actually was part of the conversation. And Greg and I have talked about this before. The Yukon may be the most creative political environment in the country. It was until about 3 or 4 years ago, not so much now. Northwest Territories has taken over as the more creative place. But it's clear in my mind that Greg played no small role in actually making that happen and making a sort of a data-rich analytical environment possible in a relatively small territory. So I'm delighted to have Greg with us. He's actually here for the week with us here in Saskatoon. So if anybody in Regina wants to spend some time talking to him, we can hook him up with a Skype call or a video link to have further conversations. We're doing a big project at the International Center of Northern Governance and Development, establishing a statistical baseline in northern Saskatchewan for use by the communities in an active and proactive sort of way. And Greg has helped us work through a huge mass of data, making it available not just for us for our research purposes, but our goal is to actually make it available for all the people in the north, including government and administrative personnel. So we're trying to replicate in northern Saskatchewan what Greg accomplished in the Yukon. So with that overly long introduction, I'm delighted to introduce Greg Finnegan to you. Greg?
Thank you very much. I have to say I'm dying to meet this guy. He sounds really interesting. Wonderful introduction. So today we're going to speak on two issues. The first lecture is the issue of fly-in, fly-out, taken from a 30,000-foot level by a statistician
who recently got his grubby little hands on a fabulous data set from the Canadian Revenue Agency, which links fly-in workers or receiving workers and sending workers from each and every province and territory in Canada. This is part of the Alberta shadow population work being done by Statistics Canada through Revenue Canada. And data of this nature has never been available to us. Now, for those of you who are very good at critiquing bad statistics, I only have 6 years of data, but it costs $120,000 or so dollars. So please don't be critical. I didn't have to pay for it, thank God. But it's a small data set, so it's anything we have in the way of projections and correlations and trends are all premised and with the caveat, I should say, of it's only 6 years of data. So it could be questionable. So in a sense, with this first study, we're going to be looking at trying to vet this six-year data set against other data sets coming from the Government of Canada, which seem logical to correlate. The story here is about labor in the north and how receiving employees, those coming in, the flying in employees, are impacting the people with the least capacity and the people having challenges getting into the labor force. The second lecture I'm going to give is going to address a happier story, which is the rise of the new local states, the First Nations self-governing communities with their own lands, modern treaty societies, and the development of their civil services. And it's, again, a bit of an overview at this point. And again, it's quantitative data. And in both of these cases, I think more qualitative research needs to be done to, shall we say, flip the coin, see the other side of the issue from a different perspective, and see how well the hard data combined with the softer qualitative image of place, feeling, and concept of place by the people, the workers, the employees, how well they balance. So I'll just move very quickly. Air North, being a Yukoner, we're always, this plane is no longer flying. If you're coming up to the Yukon, we actually have modern planes, but this was the original Air North. Air North is one of our wonderful little success stories, I think 51% owned by the Vuntut Gwichin from Old Crow. So on my way down, I met a traveler, and he was sitting across from me in the airport. I said, this guy's wearing a Stat Oil winter coat with Stat Oil on it. Stat Oil is the huge Norwegian, I guess, state-owned corporation in oil. I'm looking at him. I said, in Norwegian, I said, no, I didn't. I looked at him, and I said, you work for Stat Oil? And he said, yes. I said, where do you live? Faroe. I said, Faroe, the old mining community that's been closed for 20 years, where you can had 2,000 people and you can pick up a house for $15,000? He said, yes. And I said, tell me your story. So he had been a young man in the north working at Faroe as a miner. Faroe was the last community of its style in the north, really, which was a purpose-built mining town. About 2,000 people with all the accoutrements you'd want in public service and public goods and services and infrastructure. He now lives there, flies out to Alberta to work. So he's a Yukon sending employee. Okay, I'm a Yukon sending employee. I'm being paid. Actually, I'm not being paid. I'm basically been coming out of the Yukon and I'm spreading knowledge. He was spreading oil and gas, I guess. Wonderful story of a man who's living that fly-in, fly-out lifestyle. So that was a very interesting little piece there. So in 2013, Economic Insights, a very useful journal to read on a regular basis to understand how statisticians and economists working from quantitative data see the Canadian economy, started working on and publishing their first pieces on the shadow population. This is the work of Laporte and Liu, economists and statisticians at Statistics Canada. So I've talked with them about their work. And this is one of the nice things. They're very approachable. This gives us a rare glimpse of the migratory nature of Canadian interprovincial labor into and out of the provinces and territories and using Canadian Revenue Agency data to map the flows. This data is not accessible to the public. You could not actually build this data set yourself. It has to be
custom built by Stats Canada. Okay, so receiving employees, literally, if you are flying from Saskatchewan into Yukon to work, you're a receiving employee to Yukon, and I'm a sending employee, being a resident of Yukon, flying out, and I'm getting a paycheck from the University of Saskatchewan. So CRA, Canada Revenue Agency, would say, well, Greg Finnegan lives in Whitehorse, but he's getting salary from Saskatchewan. And so they're able to track that through a series of data sets. Okay? Usually when we talk about fly-in, fly-out, we're really talking about one person flying from Newfoundland to the tar sands, oil sands, and back, the same person. With the Stats Canada data, we're talking about receiving and sending employees. So both sides of the coin. So these are the files. Now, I presume this will all be available if people want to know more about this. You can go on to the Stats Canada websites and find out what these files mean. You're all doing your taxes right now, so you know what your T4s are. And so this is the four data sets that they use to track people who are migrating to work. Now, I have a long history of interest in labor migration. My BA honors thesis, which is a massive study of the fur trade labor flows from Quebec across Canada, which were called Les Engagés pour le West. And these were literally contracts, thousands and thousands of contracts that I mapped out. So I originally started with people, paddle in, paddle out. It's supposed to be a joke. I don't go like that one. I'm sorry. Shut up. So there is, of course, a body of literature that looks at flying in, fly out. Dr. Keith Story from Memorial is one of the best historically in this. Markey, Story, Hessler, University of Northern British Columbia, I believe, or SFU, Simon Fraser, Markey, yeah. Carter's doing her PhD at Carleton, and Gertie, last name here is quite long, and she's from University of Vienna, and she's done most of her fly-in, fly-out work in Russia, but is now working in the Yukon, and I'm helping her out with her work and linkages there. And that's the other thing, if you're looking at working in the North, you need networks, you need to build your networks of local people to work with, and you know, we're very easy to get along with. Okay, so Keith Story's 2010 work basically talks about the state of research here, and he's basically saying that, you know, there's just a lack of systematic national data collection by agencies, and there is. We talk about the labor force survey, the survey of employment and payroll hours, et cetera, et cetera. None of these surveys give us an adequate view of migratory labor of this nature. So his comment is data are poor and estimates vary. Now, with the North, you would think it wouldn't be that hard. There are only, you know, a couple mines open at any one time. In the Yukon, I think there's only one mine that's open right now. The other two that have been open have closed. There's only about four mines open at any one time, I think, in the Northwest Territories, and maybe one or two open right now in Meadow Lake, Meadowbank, and one other, I think, open in Nunavut. So you could call the companies and talk to them. Well, that's possible. In Northwest Territories, the government requires the department, the mining firms, to report on fly-in, fly-out. But there's a lot of mining that takes place that has nothing to do with picking up a rock and sending it anywhere, for the most part. A lot of it's exploration. And I think actually majority of the people I'm looking at in the fly-in, fly-out world are working in exploration companies. At one time, over 90 firms were doing exploration in the Yukon actively with camps. And that's impossible to call up and do the research. There's another problem there, is that they're not really interested in helping out researchers figure out how many people are working for them and where they're coming from, because these are the biggest assets that these mining exploration firms have are their staff. Okay, so fuzzy data, got some limited number of mines open. Mining staff used to fly in for, you know, weeks on end, and then a few days out and weeks back in. So that's all changing. Most mining companies now have 2 weeks in, 2 weeks out. And then more recently in the 2000 on, CBAs, comprehensive benefit agreements, and IBAs have come into play, impact benefit agreements, with the First Nations. And this is should be setting aside or a number of positions for people of Aboriginal descent and locally in these communities, which are most impacted or in the traditional, the mines are in the traditional territories of these communities. So that's should be starting to offset some of the demand for outside labor, hypothetically. So in some cases, we have targets of upwards of 55% for Aboriginal employment in some of these mine sites. Unfortunately, reaching 16% seems to be about as high as you can go. One of the problems we've had in the north is local hires, even Aboriginal local hires, be it Inuit or First Nation, get hired at the mine site as a local hire. But after a year or 6 months of really good paychecks and stable employment, social conditions in the neighborhood can be problematic for them because they're now the place to go because this is the family that's got large income. And so studies out of Northwest Territories by the Bureau of Statistics there have indicated that sometimes in the neighborhood of 15 to 20% of the working population hired locally now lives in Edmonton or places south, and they've become fly-in, fly-out themselves. Can't force people to live in one location. So I'm going to move through to a little bit of the data. These were the mines open in the period 2004 to 2009. As you can see, the Minto mine is the only mine that was open in the Yukon during this period. In the Northwest Territories, we have Kangtung, which is right on the boundary with Yukon. I think it's serviced through Yukon. And then we have our various mines, the diamond mines, of course. And during this period, Meadowbank hadn't opened yet. So we had Lupin and Jericho, which were both, Lupin was just closing up and Jericho was very short-lived and had problems with its productivity. This is a bit too much information, I think, for one slide, but we do, if you could just take a look at the data flow here, try to just picture the numbers at the bottom, maybe. So in the Yukon, the interprovincial receiving employees increased by almost 50%, but the labor force only increased by 5%. In the Northwest Territories, we actually saw a drop in the receiving employees, those flying in, by about 9%, and an increase in the labor force of 3.5%. And in Nunavut, we have interprovincial receiving employees increases by 35%, and the total labor force increased by 27.4%. Unfortunately, we have an asterisk beside that. Statisticians are wonderful for things like asterisks and letters A and little signs of various nature. In 2007, between 2007 and 2008, and that's why I changed the scale of the font, the survey for the labor force survey in Nunavut moved from the top 10 communities to the top 19 communities. So we have some challenges there for interpretation of data. So even with a six-year data run, which is problematic to begin with, we do have some challenges as well. So sending and receiving employees. What I was surprised at was the number of sending employees from Nunavut out to other jurisdictions. I assumed there would be a lot of receiving employees, but the data set clearly shows a considerable sending employees as well. I was quite stunned when I saw almost 1,600 people being sent out in 2004. But having talked with senior bureaucrats in Nunavut, who were there at the time, their memory of that is that they were sending a lot of people out for training in the fisheries and elsewhere, and the paychecks were from Newfoundland's government and from Quebec government, and for whatever reason, they got captured in the CRA data. So they're a bit of an anomaly. Northwest Territories, far less in the way of sending employees. So we have the net employee receiving net on the far column there, running from 4,818 through to 6,599 in 2007, and then dropping off with the recession 2007-8. The diamond mines were very quick to lay off staff in this period. Now, when we look at Northwest Territories and we look at its numbers, the mining firms are very much a high percentage of this population. When we look at Nunavut's numbers, that's exploration population. And when we look at Yukon's numbers, it's primarily exploration, but also in 2007, 8, 9, of course, is the break point when Minto Mine opens, and you can see the immediate need of Minto Mine for receiving employees, people being flown into place. The Yukon, which has a very skilled labor force for the most part, was actually sending out more employees than receiving in 2004, 5, and 6. And I remember coaching a little league soccer team in 2007, and two of the dads on that team worked in Alberta, one as a machinist and the other in the oil fields as a heavy-duty equipment driver. And that's, you know, so Whitehorse was a bedroom community, in a sense, for the oil sands. So we end up playing with a lot of data, and we end up doing correlations and running data. So I'm not going to stress on this right now. I'm going to get some patterns. Patterns are nice. People like pictures with graphs. So here's a very simple graph. Number of sending employees, 2004, 2009. So you can see the patterns there. Yukon and Northwest Territory is a very similar pattern. This is the number of receiving employees, and as you can see, well over 7,000, upwards of 8,000 receiving employees in Northwest Territories. Nunavut in the middle, Yukon at the bottom. Again, the Yukon labor force is more skilled than the other two, and has less requirement for outside labor. So we also then played around with some correlations. One of the things you'll notice in when you're looking at labor force survey data from the census, because labor force survey doesn't get down to the level of individual communities, but if you can look at the census data, 1996, 2001, 2006, and the NHS, the National Household Survey, 2011, horrible thing. When you look at those data points, you can actually get down to unemployment rates in First Nations or small villages. One of the things you'll notice in that time span is unemployment rates in a lot of First Nation communities have dropped. They've dropped from, say, 30, 40% in some places down into the low teens. And that looks good, but it's false. It's a false measure. Because what's happened is, as you see over here, the not in labor force, the discouraged workers, the people not looking for work, but it also includes, you know, family members taking care of children at home and things of this nature, the reproduction of labor, shall we say. But for the most part, we see, and when we're playing with Nunavut, we're also looking at a very young population and very high youth unemployment rates, which we'll see in a later graph. So here we see the pattern here. We ran a correlation. Correlations can be from negative one to positive one, and this correlation was 0.907, so a very strong correlation between the number of receiving employees and the increase in the number of people not in the labor force. When I showed this to Francis Abel at Carleton University, a renowned professor of northern policy issues, her immediate term of reference was internal colonialism. And so this was an interesting piece that she was looking at with me. This is the correlation for Yukon, not in labor force, and interprovincial employees. By the way, receiving employees could include medical doctors or nurses. It could include consultants coming up and working in the north, but they're a smaller percentage, obviously. So this gives us a correlation for Yukon, fairly high at 0.813. And then the one for Northwest Territories is lower because of the nature of the more permanent jobs in mining. The other thing we played around with was correlation. One of the things we use in the North to try understanding what's going to be happening with the GDP is we look at mineral exploration. Mineral exploration year in and year out. I have to speak louder because I'm now being overcome by a large drill. And the correlation here is almost perfect at 0.978. And this is receiving employees run against mineral exploration. And we really think mineral exploration is one of the dominant is one of the dominant factors involved in bringing labor into the North. I mentioned earlier the youth unemployment rates. So this is our youth unemployment rates from the Labor Force Survey. And youth unemployment rates for Yukon, again, a higher capacity population is pretty much level at around 10 to 11%, barely rising over this time period. In the Northwest Territories, it's problematic, rising from around 10% in 2004 to over 20% in, almost 20% in 2012. We'd project out to 2015 at over. And if we run the we run a trend line through the Nunavut, we see a horrific situation with potentially over 35% of the youth being unemployed. We also have to remember Nunavut has the lowest high school graduation rate in Canada by a mile. So one of the things this paper is being published in Polar Geography as a research note shortly. So the data, to me, appears logical. It seems to be in accord with labor force survey data and with mineral expenditures data, which comes from Statistics Canada. We seem to have a strong correlation between annual increases in receiving employees in Nunavut and the increase in combined unemployment rate and not in labor force. The Nunavut has a very young population with low educational attainment, very high youth unemployment, and a lot of discouraged workers. And workers in Nunavut really do have to travel incredibly difficult distances, not just long distances, but incredibly difficult distances to get to work sites. And they may not actually in some cases be a very healthy situation for their families if they're away working. Poor preparation for extractive industry labor markets and spin-off jobs. And I give the example here of being at the Frobisher Bay Inn for a RESDA meeting recently, where all of the bouncers were very large, well-built, muscular men from Nigeria who I chatted with. All the bar staff were from Quebec. They were young French-Canadian kids. And even the janitor was from Newfoundland. Now, I figure when the bouncers and the janitors and the bar staff have to be imported, you've got to challenge with some of the issues on the labor market in the community, particularly when the unemployment rate is still running 30%, 25 to 30% in some cases. So there's a real mismatch between the capacity of the labor force and basic work level entry-level jobs. So I'm going to fly Air North home. That's the more modern plane. Air North, by the way, now flies to Ottawa. Okay, so very quickly, I'm also very interested in the evolution of First Nations government in the Yukon. The Yukon, as Ken noted, politically was on the forefront in Canada on governance and self-government and land treaties, modern land treaties. We have 14 First Nations in the Yukon. Oh, hi! A Yukoner just came in. Whoa! And sorry, we don't see each other very often, fairly outside of the territory. And so this study is going to be looking at public administration and the concept of territory and the First Nations had territory. They existed well before the gold rush of 1898 and the sudden interest of Canada in its Arctic. They lost their sense of place. They lost their connection to their lands. They were overdrafted by a federal bureaucracy out of Ottawa. And in a sense, from the 1990s on, they've been re-territorialization has been taking place. And by this, I mean they've been reclaiming their land through land negotiations. They've been reclaiming their land through development programs, sustainable development programs, and by bringing their people back together into a more active decision-making, greater fate control. So this, very quickly, if you haven't seen the Yukon, Ken and I are from Whitehorse. There's the communities. And one of the things you saw immediately see about this is not a map of Western boundaries. These are overlapping boundaries. These are shared traditional territories. And this comes into the court cases in Canada now, in the Yukon, in British Columbia, And the issues, and Ken was just quoted in the newspaper this last week with regard to, let's see, can you see the Watson Lake area? I'm pointing at things you can't see in Regina, I'm sorry. If you look in the Watson Lake area, that's the Kaska Nation, so Ross River, Watson Lake, that's the Kaska Nation, and they are not under a modern treaty. They're still called an Indian Act band. And they are arguing recently that you still have to a duty to consult with us. So I'm not going to spend too much time on the overarching academic geography of all this because you're more of a business school group, so we'll get more to the numbers. So First Nations traditional boundaries do not conform to the superimposed European concepts delineated by internal Canadian boundaries, nor the U.S., Canada international boundary. And the example of that is our dear friends from the Vuntut Gwich'in, who really have existed in the area of Alaska, Old Crow, and into Fort McPherson and Northwest Territories, and have exchanged food resources back and forth from good years to bad years, or trading caribou for salmon. Homeland Security found this somewhat questionable and closed down the trade between the caribou hunters of Old Crow and the salmon fishers from Alaska because they were worried about terrorism, I guess, up there. Anyway, there was a master's thesis done here, which touched base on that, at the University of Saskatchewan. Remember the woman speaking on it? Her name doesn't come to one of David Natcher's students. Most of the boundaries are, there's lots of cross-boundary interactions between the various communities. There's linguistic groups, and there's a fair amount of sharing of resources right from Alaska. Like, there's a intertribal relationships on salmon on the Yukon River between Alaska and Canada. Why do we have territory? Well, shelter and security and a springboard to opportunity are two of the major points people speak about. And security and opportunity require internal organization of territory and an organization of external relations. Now, the First Nations in the Yukon are starting to move into that realm now. They are they have the internal organization, they're building their civil services, they're drawing down powers from Yukon or Canada in some cases, and they're starting to develop external relations. And some of those external relations are being battled out in the courts, and they are frequently winning those battles. So there's a devolution process that was taking place between Yukon devolved first, Northwest Territories going through the process now, and at the same time that was happening in the Yukon, the First Nations were battling for greater control over their own local economy and local their lands and territory. There's a lot of literature. David Harvey speaks to this. O'Toole and Luke speak to this. Basically, these new First Nation territories with land and cash are re-territorializing themselves through the investments at home and through economic development of their traditional territories. Now, what's that mean? Well, that means that when I was getting on a plane one day, I saw a friend of mine who was the executive director of the Yukon Indian Development Corp, which is represents all 17 First Nations in the northern BC Yukon area. And Stanley Knowles is his name. And I said, Stanley, where are you going? He said, well, I'm going to New York City. I said, vacation. He said, no, I'm going down to negotiate investments for the Vuntut Gwich'in to buy more shares into the Air North. So here's Old Crow. Here's Old Crow, it's a 3R place. It's really, really remote. There it is up on the top of the map, and that's what it looks like. And there's Stanley Knowles going down to New York City to broker money in the New York money markets so that the Vuntut Gwich'in, a community of about 400 and some people, could buy more shares into Air North, which they have controlling interest in, 51%. The Vuntut Gwich'in are also helping to redevelop the waterfront in Whitehorse, much to the chagrin of our local Ton Gwich'in and Quanlin Dunn, who got outbid for these parcels of land on the waterfront, Ken smiling, And they're building these beautiful, new, fairly modern, northern look buildings. This is a commercial on the first floor, businesses or offices on the second, and the third is high-end condominiums. So welcome to the new world of First Nations economies. Okay, so here's the First Nations civil services generate the core stability, I feel, that these small territories require to maintain their security and to generate opportunity and to deal with the day-to-day problems of their local community. And that's important. It means that decisions are made locally on the day that the problems could occur versus having to send off to a federal bureaucracy, be it in Yellowknife or Ottawa or even Whitehorse, which is distant, remote, and not necessarily have anything to do culturally or socially with the community where the decisions have to be made. Yukon First Nations have development corporations. These are usually held in trust or at arm's length, and the First Nations peoples are the owners of them. These are supported by natural resources and land ownership. They also have invested, most of them have invested their financial settlements, their annual financial settlements go into investments, such as land development projects, existing buildings, resources like technology companies, Air North, building corporations. Again, the courts are also a place where the civil services and these local governments are battling the relationship between Canada and securing their rights. And here's the most recent of these lawsuits start in 1973 and move right through to today. June 26, 2014, the Supreme Court decision of Roger William versus BC. The court, you know, there is a duty to consult is the basic bottom line here. And that also comes into play in the Yukon on duty to consult with the Kaska First Nation, Ross River, I guess. So moving along to some of the data. So when we start playing with the data on First Nations, we can look at the survey of employment and payroll hours. And the reason we have this data is because a First Nation called me up and said, we're really embarrassed, but we're pretty sure we're giving out more paychecks than we have employees. I said, yeah, that could be happening. So they said, do you know how many people work for us? I said, no, it's not data I collect. It's outside of my realm of ability to look at it. But I'll see what I can find out for you. And so what I did find out is I couldn't help them, but we gave them ideas. What we did was we called Stats Canada and said, there's something called Line 914. And Line 914 in the Survey of Employment and Payroll Hours, and you got to recognize there's just hundreds of surveys that Stats Canada generates from survey work or from administrative data. This is administrative data. This is, again, coming from T4 slips and that your employer sends into the government. And this tells us how many people are working in First Nations governments and what kind of wages they're earning. And I thought, wow, that's great data. I want to look at this. So here we have First Nation employment in First Nations government in Canada. Ontario leads the way, followed by BC, Quebec, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and that's proportional. I mean, that's really where the vast majority of Aboriginal people live in Canada. About 25% of the Yukon's population are Aboriginal, First Nation, and about 50% of the Northwest Territories population is First Nation. So there's about 7,500 people of Aboriginal descent in Yukon, so 7,500 in Yukon. And I'd say about 20,000 roughly in Northwest Territories. We were also able to get similar data for Alaska because they have tribal governments there. And so we were able to pin across the north, the three. We don't have Nunavut data there because Nunavut's a very different world when it comes to civil service. What seems to be incredible is that there are three times more people working in Aboriginal government in Yukon than in Northwest Territories, whereas Northwest Territories has about three times as many people. Again, you know, a lot of numbers here, but the message here is that Aboriginal public administration as a percentage of all employment for Canada runs about just upwards of a third of 1%. In the Yukon, it's risen from around 6% to almost 7.5%, 7.38. And in the Northwest Territories, it's declined from around 2.5% down to 2%. One of the things we want to look at as well is what kind of employment First Nations have. And when I've shown this to First Nation chiefs and councils and to leaders in the community, they look at this and they go, my God, we've got $60+ million a year in salaries from our First Nations governments going into our communities. Now, you got to recognize, Yukon's a very white horse-centric society. We are 36,000 people, roughly, and 26,000 of them live in Whitehorse. So most people who are First Nation, the majority of First Nation people, 75% of First Nation people, live outside of Whitehorse in the little villages, like Dawson City, like Teslin, like Watson Lake, like Old Crow. And so getting this money into this $61 million into the First Nation economy through wages is money getting into these little villages. And it's a much better way of than the welfare state that had existed. So that gives you some interest in the numbers. You'll see the break point between 2003 and 2008. Anyone who's worked with small area statistics know that places like Prince Edward Island or Yukon quite often get dropped out for confidentiality purposes. So for confidentiality purposes, I cannot access any data on this from 2003 to 2008. But we still have some data to play with, which is nice. What does this mean from GDP? Well, it means that Aboriginal government, Aboriginal administration, represents about 3%. It was about 3.6. It's now about 3% of the GDP of the Yukon. And if mining is declining, 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, as mining continues to go through its bust, that number of 3% will probably rise again. One of the other things I like to play around with is breaking this kind of data, which is the Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal data. So this is these are the unemployment rates in the Yukon for Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal. Aboriginal are in red, non-Aboriginal are in blue. So you still see that there is a major difference between whether or not you're employed, there's a definite impact for your Aboriginal people on the employment front. You'll also notice that in 2008, 2009, when the recession hit, the last hired were the first fired. So you see this big bump of First Nations unemployment suddenly in 2008-9, rising over 20%, and then has been decreasing again since then. You don't see that increase in the non-Aboriginal community. The other thing, I've got to find a better way to graph this. This is ugly as sin. I apologize. but what this is zero up top is all wages, all public administration wages in Canada is the norm. So the norm is zero, okay? So the norm is at the top is zero. And Aboriginal income for Yukon is in blue. So it started in 2002 at 70% of the national average, dropped down to 64%, and has risen steadily to negative 0.28 or a positive 72. So it's at 72% in 2012. Having said that, if you look at the same numbers for Canada, Aboriginal government employment is wages are far lower, average wages are far lower in Canada in general and are worst in Canada in Northwest Territories. So this is what we can do when we've got data from the Survey of Employment and Payroll Hours. The zero is highly held up, or a high percentage of that zero is federal wages, and provincial and territorial come shortly after that, and then municipal is somewhere between First Nations and provincial territorial. And so this is another way of looking at public administration. So of all the public administration in the Yukon, 21% work for Aboriginal government. In Saskatchewan, the next highest at 12%, Manitoba's at 10%. Whereas in Northwest Territories, it's at 9%, and in Alaska, you're down to about 6%. So this gives you an impression of what happens in First Nations communities when you have land treaties, when you have the evolution of local government, self-government in the Aboriginal communities, First Nations communities, and the rise of the civil service. Now, some of the things I want to play with next is I'd like to be able to break those big bar charts into Aboriginal employees and non-Aboriginal employees. Now, anecdotally, talking with executive directors of First Nations governments, they've been increasingly trying to replace their dependency on non-Aboriginals in senior positions with Aboriginal people. And I think we're starting to see that on this graph here, where Aboriginal public administration has risen 2011, 2012, 2013, and we've seen a corresponding drop in Aboriginal unemployment rate. So next step is to get research money to get in there and talk to the executive directors and directors of HR about Aboriginal employment and what they're looking for and how they're growing their staff, how they're retaining their staff. We need to have some kind of survey for program evaluation of First Nations staff. I don't think that's being done anywhere yet. So we want to be able to break out First Nations staff against non-First Nations staff, and we want to be able to also look at that from the perspective of National Occupational Codes, or NOC. We want to look at what they're doing in the way of training and career development programs, and we want to look at the role of First Nation government in local economy and employment. And certainly if you're pumping 60-some million dollars plus into the economy, you're making a difference, and that money's not wasn't there or isn't there in the Northwest Territories, which is right next door. Okay, so that concludes my two talks.